Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, the host of this channel, and today we'll be talking to Elizabeth Bernstein, the author of Brokered Subjects, Sex, Trafficking, and the Politics of Freedom from the University of Chicago Press. So, hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me. It's great to be here.
That's wonderful. This is very exciting. I gotta tell you, it's so much fun to talk to people about their work in this really kind of, it's, you know, academic but informal way.
Right.
So how about you, Brokered Subjects is your newest work. So how did you, like, tell me about yourself and how you came to it?
Yeah, sure. So you may know I have a book before this on a related topic called Temporarily Yours, Intimacy, Authenticity, and the Commerce of Sex. So this book is in some ways a little bit of a follow-up to the first book that I wrote, which was written in the late 1990s and early 2000s about sexual commerce and globalization. And in the earlier book, I was looking at transformations in sexual commerce in three cities, San Francisco, Amsterdam, and Stockholm. And I was interested both in the changing dynamics of sex work and in the changing legal regimes that were emerging in different contexts, globally, really. But I was focusing on three, what I call post-industrial cities in the U.S. And Western Europe, three cities that were sort of relatively similar in certain ways, but were changing their laws in opposite directions. And in the sort of, I'm calling Temporarily Yours now the prequel book, because it was sort of looking both at the phenomenon and sort of at the emergence of burgeoning attention to this issue of sexual commerce, not for the first time historically. Certainly there have been other historical moments where it had also occupied central stage politically, but there was gathering attention again. In the earlier book, I also began to, just in the preface and in the conclusion, I began to write about something that was emerging at the tail end of my research process around the year 2000, which was this new resurgent discourse of sex trafficking, which had been basically a discourse that had been in a deep slumber for about 100 years since an earlier, what I'll call a sort of a panic around white slavery the century prior. And what was beginning to emerge in the early 2000s, really, was a really new attention, new focus to this issue. Lots and lots of political actors, you know, not just small cadres of feminists, but everybody was getting, you know, interested and concerned about this, you know, governments, transnational governing bodies, you know, also activists, but, you know, increasingly it was circulating in popular discourse as well. And so in some sense, like, the first question that propelled my research for this new book was, you know, what's happening? Why is this discourse come back after it had disappeared? What relevance does it have for the phenomenon at hand, which I just spent, you know, almost a decade studying? And so, you know, and interestingly, when I was, you know, working with the sex workers who were migrating, many, many migrant sex workers in all these cities, they themselves were not using the discourse of trafficking. So I actually watched the discourse emerge as I was finishing up the first book and became quite curious about where it was coming from and what it was doing.
Okay. And so I like the idea that this is a life's work here.
Yeah. Well, I'm still young. I mean, there's other directions, but it's a good chunk of my life. Yeah. It's been a couple of decades already. Yeah.
Right. I find this very funny in the whole conversation. Oh, what do you do? Well, sex work.
Yeah.
In a different way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. The academic, intellectual arm of it, but sure. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm familiar with this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. So I see how this brought you to your topic. Where are you now? Academically.
Oh, academically.
My kitchen. No.
Exactly. In New York City looking at your photograph. No, I am, I'm at Barnard College in Columbia University. So Barnard College is a women's college, which is affiliated but also part of Columbia University. So Columbia University has a number of different colleges which comprise it, Columbia College, Teachers College, etc. Barnard College is a still autonomous women's college that is part of that. And so unlike Harvard Radcliffe, Brown Pembroke, it never fully merged. So I'm affiliated with both institutions, which is nice. And I teach in women's gender and sexuality studies and in sociology. So I'm trained as a sociologist. And and that's part of my story, too, in terms of answering your prior question of how I got to where I got in pursuing this book and how I came to be interested. Really, my interest in the topic of sex work initially was spurred, as a very young person by reading feminist sexuality debates, the feminist, it came to be known as the feminist sex war. So it was really spurred by a set of feminist interests as a very young person. I was fascinated by the debates around sexuality that were taking place still in the 90s when I was a student. And then when I started my graduate training in sociology, which was in the Bay Area at UC Berkeley, just across the bay from San Francisco, I was developing a whole new set of tools to think about these questions. And as I write about in my earlier book also, there was an element of serendipity, because while I was a graduate student there, San Francisco started looking into the possibility of decriminalizing prostitution, which was getting a lot of press. And it seemed like a really interesting opportunity for me as a burgeoning sociologist, somebody with longstanding feminist interests, in these questions and politics of sex, to see what happens when a city like San Francisco tries to do that, and how it happens, who the players are, what the interests are, what the fallout is, what the impact is on the sex workers, and so forth. So I think I've taken this question on a little bit of a tangent, but that's how I got where I am, and what I'm still trying to do now. I remember my thread is merge the sort of my sociological interests and my feminist interests and interests in, gender and sexual politics, gender and sexuality. And one of the methodological threads that has run through both books as well, is an interest to melding, serious engagement with theory and politics on the one hand with rigorous empirical research on the other. And that's the sociology part. And that's what I've tried to bring to both projects.
Oh, great. Okay. As a feminist and as a feminist scholar, it's really interesting to see how this debate about pornography, prostitution, sex work writ large, and then the conversation about sexual assault has kind of developed from the 80s,
Right. I agree. Right. It's really, and it's a very, very strange moment where living in it, as we speak, of course, because I would say I'm writing yet another afterword to this book, I would have even more things to say. But at some point, one has to finish and move on to the next project. Because things are things are evolving kind of quickly and sort of in unexpected ways, I think, as we speak. I mean, on the one hand, there's strong continuities. On the other hand, there's also some new twists and turns. As per your allusion to sexual assault just a minute ago, right, which has been the newest twist in all of this.
Well, it's astounding, to think about, there was a period in our lives when it seemed possible to eliminate prostitution or possible to eliminate pornography. And now, I mean, pornography is here to stay, right?
Yeah. Well, right, right. I think probably as long as capitalism is, I think that's likely. So what to say about that? You know, it seemed possible to eliminate prostitution or pornography. I think that that was one vision that that certain strains of feminism certainly had, and it, you know, it did look like that right at the emergence of the feminist sex wars in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. And certainly when I was a young person, I was also engaged by that political vision. And when I first went to Sweden and Stockholm, and, you know, and at least in a US context, I know it's different in Amsterdam, but when I first went as a young person to write that component of the book, you know, everybody had said, you must go to Sweden, you must go to Stockholm. Where at Gutenberg is actually where I started out, but at Gutenberg, but you know, Sweden was supposed to be the feminist mecca. So, like, if you want to see how things are done well, you go to Sweden, and chapter 9 of every feminist sociology book had a chapter on Sweden to see how things could be done better, perfectly in feminist ways. And then, you know, I got there, and there was plenty of pornography, and I thought, it's not feminist, you know, right? But in retrospect, I think I was quite young and naive. And so, you know, one of the other threads that I think has run through my own intellectual trajectory and also sort of courses through these two books, and all of the work I intend to do in the future is actually, you know, thinking about what's often considered the sort of, you know, micropolitics of the body, the gender and sexuality, and trying to connect those to larger sets of political formations. So political economy, geopolitics, migration flows, militarism, the rise of the carceral state, and so forth. And to see these as actually integrally interrelated and you know, with causal chains running in both directions, so mutual strains of influence, but rather than separate. And so the way I would answer that question now about whether, you know, it's a it makes sense from a feminist perspective to hope that, you know, prostitution or pornography don't exist or wouldn't exist. I mean, I think that there would be a lot of other things that would have to change in the world, not just around sex, before those two were not prevalent phenomena.
Yeah, it really is hard to imagine. And I'm not certain I want to imagine it, but.
Right. Or maybe, but I think, you know, you can't, I think to treat these as sort of singular cases, right, in, you know, a late capitalist economy where, you know, everything is commodified and everything is for sale, and to expect sex to somehow be exceptional is not realistic.
Yeah, absolutely not. And all right. So tell me just what is your overarching argument in this book? What does your book argue? What does it prove? What is your contribution to the discourse?
Yeah. So let me, before I get to specify the argument, let me just circle back a little bit to specify the question, right? So in some sense, yeah, the question that this book is tackling, phrased most colloquially, is like, what happened? Why did this discourse come back? And what is it doing? You know, why is everybody talking about trafficking and sexual slavery again now? And what happens? And then, you know, sort of a, you know, at a meta level, the question is, you know, what are the implications of speaking about sexual violence in the ways that have become most prevalent, and talking about speaking about and addressing sexual violence using you know, what I call in the book carceral solutions or punitive solutions or punishing solutions. And then, you know, I would say like an implicit question, which is the subtext. I don't think it's too remote to perceive, but it's there, is, you know, what might be a better way to think about questions of sexual violence in this moment of what I call neoliberalism, like capitalism, right, et cetera. So those are the big questions, right? And so, you know, in terms of the answers that I try to present to these questions, a couple of things, right? So first of all, you know, you asked about the overarching argument. The overarching, you know, framed most broadly, it's a version what I said to you in response to the prior question, right? Which is, I think that in order to answer these questions, you know, we actually need to have a bigger frame, a bigger lens, and look more broadly than most commentators have. So when I set out to write this book, there had been a few critical pieces written about the trafficking discourse, but you know, really smart people like Joe Dozema, who's an ad scholar activist, and a couple of others. And certainly there had been a large critical feminist and historical literature on the earlier white slave scare, and we could talk more about that, of the last century. And then there were people who were beginning to write about what was happening now. There had been essays and so forth, mostly saying, and some people who, you know, work closely with sex workers saying, like, look, this doesn't describe people's experiences. You know, sex workers, migrant sex workers, even migrant sex workers who've experienced violence don't understand themselves to be trafficked. This framework doesn't work for them. They understand their labor in a different way. They understand the violence they've experienced in a different way. This is not a helpful framework. So there had been critiques. And so I was interested in these critiques and extending them empirically. And I do a lot of that in the book. But I was also interested, and again, here's the sociologist in me, and an explanatory piece, you know, the why question, given that it's not descriptive of people's experiences. It's not, it doesn't feel particularly helpful to sex workers. Why is everybody talking about trafficking again? And not just here, but globally, and not just activists and state agents, but corporations and Google and so on and so forth. And it's from my beginning women's studies students, everybody's heard of trafficking now. That wouldn't have been the case 15 years ago, for example, right? And everybody, you know, when they hear sex work, they think trafficking too. So, you know, so what happened? Trying to explain that. As an answer to that, you know, just to summarize a fairly complex argument, and if you looked at the book, you know, a million footnotes, and, there's a lot there, and the argument is fairly elaborate, but I think we can say it in a sort of simple way, which is that there's three things that I really identify as components of the political and economic moment in which we live, and that I think are important to understanding the reemergence of this discourse. So the first one I talk about is carceral feminism. I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. The second is militarized humanitarianism, and the third is what I call redemptive capitalism. And so let me say just a little bit about each of these. And what each of these phrases or frameworks points to is again, this sort of simultaneous transformation of what we like to think of as personal or intimate life in conjunction with, broader transformations in the political and economic sphere. And what each of these frameworks also points to, right, is a sort of, I think, some weird new ways in which power is working, where it's hard to tell what's progressive and what's conservative, what's liberatory and what's restrictive, what is radical and what is reinscribing reactionary dynamics. It's become difficult to tease these things apart, right? And I think, you know, many people are confused in the current political moment, and for good reason, right? So let me start with carceral feminism, which in a way is something I've written the most about, and I've written a couple of articles on this before the book came out, so I've been working on this for a while, and it's a kind of, I think a phrase that sort of traveled widely now. A lot of people use this phrase, but in different contexts, right, to talk about a lot of things. That I was first writing about it in 2007 when I started doing this research, and I was trying to figure out how it was in particular. And one of the things that I look at empirically in the book, when we walk through the chapters, I'll talk more about this, the alliance between mainstream feminists in the context that I was looking at and some, you know, very conservative political groups, whether it's, right-wing political think tanks like the Heritage Foundation, the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C., run by neoconservatives, also alliance with feminists and very, very conservative Christians, and how these kinds of allegiances were able to take shape. And at a certain point, in the research, fairly early on, realized that one of the things that was binding these just seemingly disparate groups together was not, you know, often feminists are sort of lampooned as having puritanical sexual politics and so forth, and, you know, they were just as conservative as Christians and so forth. I didn't really think that was the main issue, and I didn't think that that was a fair characterization. But what I did think was happening was that there was an implicit and an unspoken allegiance to the carceral state and to punitive models of gender justice that that was not made explicit, and that was in fact binding these groups together, and that everybody was taking for granted that the best way to address questions of sexual violence, be it trafficking or domestic violence or rape or sexual harassment, et cetera, was through punishment and penalty, right? And this is, and that's how it became clear to me. And so I think then you have to ask, like, how does that become common sense knowledge, right? How is it that feminists are suddenly embracing carceral state, the criminal justice system, the punitive state? That's a real question to ask. And how is it that carceral feminism becomes common sense, taken for granted, knowledge across huge swaths of the population? So the Christians, you know, too, that I spoke with, you know, many identified as feminists, right? They seem progressive in certain ways, right? But everybody was interested in criminalization and punishment, right? So, you know, for example, one of the Christian organizations that I did ethnographic work with, the International Justice Mission, you know, I go to their events and I'd be thinking, well, you know, a lot of what they're saying actually sounds pretty feminist and pretty progressive, until I began interrogating more and thinking about what's the model of justice here. And in fact, it's criminal justice, right? And
so, yeah, basically the idea that there's, that you have to, that the that justice, like policing, prosecuting, this is the only way to do away with gendered violence.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely. Policing, prosecution, longer and tougher prison sentences. And, you know, when I see this really everywhere, I mean, you know, I saw it first with this issue, but, you know, if you think about, you know, maybe we'll talk more about this later in the conversation, but, you know, some of the presumptions behind certain strands, not every strand, but certain strands of Me Too and, you know, activism. And I just got back from Spain, where I have a lot of friends. There was a, you know, a sexual assault in even the north of Spain, and there's a big feminist mobilization now because the perpetrators didn't get enough prison time. And I understand why people are furious about this, and I understand how people can say, well, you know, this is sort of the only justice we have. But I think we really need to think about that. you know, in terms of narrowing the feminist goals, you know, is it, you know, feminist victory when we get a longer, stiffer prison sentence, or might there be other
some
ways
method
to imagine, feminist action, right?
Some ways to imagine avoiding.
For example, you know,
Mm-hmm. And you know, giving women a different language, a different way to talk about these things.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So I feel like I would like to step back a second and just talk about this is your first chapter, tracing the traffic in women. Really, like shows kind of how trafficking developed, kind of the term trafficking. Yeah. I made air quotes. You couldn't see them.
I couldn't see them, but yeah. Great. Yeah. So, right. So let's see. So, and I think what I do in that chapter, right, a couple of things. You know, certainly some of the deep historical background that I've alluded to a couple of times already just in our conversation this afternoon, right? So going back to white slavery and the white slave traffic, you know, in the last century, which was a really, you know, potent discourse, which resulted in, you know, in the U.S. context, the you know, basically the, you know, the thorough criminalization of prostitution and driving people out of brothels and onto the streets, again, something I write about in the earlier historical section of my earlier book. So that's, you know, an important component of the genealogy. But then looking, you know, more recently at the more recent genealogy as well, and trying to figure out in this next round how it's come back. And I'm looking, for example, you know, at some, you know, certainly, you know, there was some feminist mobilization around this in the mid to late 70s, but it was, I would say, you know, more of a minority discourse. And figures like, you know, in the sex wars, you know, Kathleen Barry, who had a book on female sexual slavery. Although, if I can just a detour for a moment, one of the things that's interesting about early second wave feminism on these questions, when they talk about female sexual slavery, and I actually teach this book sometimes, and students are surprised. My students, you know, try and think of themselves as pro-sex feminists, and then sometimes I teach some of the so-called anti-sex feminists from this period. And in Barry's book, Female Sexual Slavery, from 79, you know, she's referring to not just prostitution, but marriage. you know, so, you know, the early feminist critique, it was more of a critique of normative heterosexuality than prostitution per se. And so one of the interesting things is how, for me, I think, looking genealogically and historically, is how prostitution then gets severed from those other broader dynamics of heterosexuality to become, you know, the solo problem, right? But I think for for much of, you know, what was called radical second wave feminism, it wasn't just a critique of prostitution; it was a critique of all of the institutions of heterosexuality, marriage, and the nuclear family included. So, you know, so this is interesting, and we have to ask how suddenly that critique drops away, and the family is not, you know, even with the current stuff around sexual assault and sexual harassment, nobody's touching the family, for example.
Oh, right? No, absolutely. Yeah, we've yeah. long abandoned all heterosexist rape. You know.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, exactly. So, but, you know, but then, but prostitution remains, you know, that's the category that gets severed off and picked up by all sorts of other commentators and political actors, and so that everybody can agree, well, there's the problem, you know, right? And especially when migrants are concerned and the main actors, and so then you have to think, well, something else is going on here, right? What else is informing the sexual politics here, right? So, so I think, you know, in this first chapter on tracing the traffic in women, I'm trying to set some of that up. I'm also trying to show, you know, I talk about some of the definitional and calculative flux. You know, one of the things that's interesting is that we lots of people use the term without precisely knowing what they're talking about. There's a way in which it doesn't matter because in a way it's impossible to know. And so one of the things that I trace is the, you know, the reemergence of the term, you know, in legal documents like the Trafficking Victims Protection Act and the UN Protocol. And there's, you know, a real lack of clarity about what anybody's talking about, and there's lack of agreement. I think, you know, at a political level, it sort of matters less because it's about feelings and emotions and affects more than it is about precise definitions. And so it captures, you know, I think it captures a sentiment about what is problematic and troubling about heterosexuality to a lot of people, and to a lesser extent capitalism, even though it's not necessarily conscious, without being... you know, and so the lack of precision in the term doesn't bother people too much, but it's, you know, I think it's important to know that, you know, in some sense, nobody really knows what it means. Nobody really knows what they're talking about, not even the legal, you know, the legal commentators and experts who put together these documents, right? That there's, you know, slippery statistics and sliding definitions, to quote my colleague, Wendy Chapkis, who's also written some nice essays on this, right? So, you know, so that's another thing that's important to look at. And a corollary to that is, you know, people always ask, especially, you know, when I've talked to sociologists about this, or when I started to, they're always like, what are the numbers? How many are we talking about? Because the CIA, initially, when they, when this issue burst back on the scene in the early 2000s, they were saying 50,000 women are trafficked into the United States every year. Now that's, you know, it's a large number. It also happens to be the same number that was circulating 100 years ago, curiously enough, when people were talking about sex trafficking, right? So, you know, so that's also interesting to think about, you know, where the numbers come from. And so, you know, then the U.S. government has kept downgrading their numbers. Well, no, not 50,000, maybe 17,000, et cetera. And so, you know, one of the things that I did, again, this is the empirical, you know, research side of me, is really looking and trying to figure out how many cases are we actually talking about. you know, also, you know, how do you measure something that nobody has clearly defined? That's another challenge, right? And so that's one of the reasons the numbers can slide around. But if I looked at different things that you could measure, well, okay, right, you know, how many T visas have been given to trafficking victims, right? And so, you know, a scant number under 2,000, even though they're, you know, supposed to be 50,000 or 17,000 victims a year, that doesn't sound like a lot. How many cases are there in New York? How many, you know, certified trafficking victims or even, you know, cases pursued? You know, this is supposed to be one of the big hubs. There's 5 cases a year. That doesn't sound like very much, right? So so the question of, you know, what it is we're talking about becomes, you know, very murky and very interesting and really makes it even, I think, more pertinent to think, you know, where does, if there's not that many cases, if, you know, comparing to something, for example, like domestic violence, for which there are actually a lot of cases, right? But much more public and political attention to this issue, right? You know, how do we explain that discrepancy? So that's sort of what I'm trying to set up in this chapter. And then, you know, the last section in which I talk about the collapse of sexual politics and neoliberal freedoms, you know, is sort of trying to begin to think about, okay, well, what, you know, what else is going on that can explain the resurgence, the burgeoning attention to this issue, if it's not, you know, if it's not just, you know, the sheer number of cases, if it's not, you know, quantitatively, you know, as enormous as is being claimed by, you know, by a long stretch, right? And, you know, what else might tell us this? And so then, you know, and I lay out some of the method that I'm going to pursue in the book. I call it an ethnography of a discourse, which is, it sounds very technical and fancy, but what I really mean is I'm just going to look, I'm going to interview people, I'm going to meet the people, I'm going to do oral histories with the people who were important in putting and propelling this discourse forward, and I'm going to see why they were so engaged with this issue, right? And why this became the issue, and what's motivating them, and how, and then how their engagement with the discourse in turn shapes the phenomenon itself. Right?
And so, of course, one of your answers, like one of the options, your convincing chapter two was about carceral feminism. Right.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. So I think there are, that's one of the places we have to start. It's really, you know, what happened with feminism, right? And so one of the things that I did was I actually, I interviewed a number of the people who were active in the original sex wars, right? Some of the very same people, you know, then found themselves working, for example, in the Bush White House, curiously enough, you know, like Laura Lederer, right? Who had written a very important book, one of the foundational texts of Take Back the Night, right? You know, which Second Wave Feminism, you know, who was then a senior advisor to George Bush on trafficking. How does that happen, right? And so
it boggles, mind boggles.
Boggling, right? You know, we're sitting at an event on the, you know, at the Hudson Institute with some very, these are not, they're not necessarily household names, but for people who follow the conservative right in America, these would be names that would be known, like Michael Horowitz, and, you know, who's sort of organizing forums and putting coalitions together, and how feminism, gets mixed up in this, and that's what I was trying to trace. And so by looking, at the feminist piece of this, the feminists who had oriented their careers or reoriented their commitments from things like pornography, right, to prostitution, to then trafficking, and how the trafficking, embracing trafficking actually became a route to national and international prominence, to policy success that they would not necessarily have had otherwise, I think. And there were people who spoke explicitly about this, that, you know, basically they were losing the sex wars domestically until the international terrain came in, until the global terrain came in, until the trafficking discourse came in. Arguments that were harder to make about sex work and prostitution when the imagined sex worker was a white person from the U.S., for example, or I'll speak about, you know, a U.S. context, now I'm going to use the scare quotes that your listeners can't see, but believe me, they're there, you know, the third world prostitute, right? You know, and how she could become a symbol of exploitation and oppression that was, much more galvanizing.
Right. One of the questions that I had here is just how much this is about, we don't have to talk about agency, right? Because the third world prostitute has none. And so we have a clear victim, which means we can have a clear perpetrator.
Right. I think that's really, really true. And race is part of that story. So the politics of race become very important, you know, and this is something that I think, earlier waves of feminism or, you know, critical commentary didn't necessarily always pay enough attention to, right? You know, this is one of these intersections, these macro intersections, the politics of race, a nation that's extremely important. You're exactly right. Yeah. So the third world prostitute is presumed to have no agency. She's just a victim. And conversely, as you just noted, right? Facilitators, mediators that she's working with can be very, very easily demonized, right? Some men of color, and this, you know, this two prongs of this are both really important, right? You need the perpetrator, you need the ideal perpetrator and the ideal victim for the discourse to work.
Right. Okay. Great. Yeah, this was a very convincing. I loved this chapter. I really enjoyed your whole book, by the way.
Thank you.
But this chapter just really spoke. I'm just putting together kind of the module we're going to do this fall on sex work.
Super. Yeah.
All right. So chapter 3 has my favorite title, though, which is
okay. right. Yeah.
Seek,
absolutely right.
Seek
right.
This trademark.
I know, right?
Great. Tell me how did that happen?
Well, so this this is from the International Justice Mission. This is their motif. Now, I think it's their academic use to borrow it for an academic analysis. So you know, so I don't. I think we're okay in terms of that, but what it captures a number of things that are condensed in the Seek Justice TM. It captures this really complex melding that we were talking about earlier, right? So progressive ambition, seek justice, that sounds good, right? That little TM, what's that trademark? Oh my goodness. This is also, this is a corporate capitalist effort at the same time, right? Right. So notably, that's what they use. And so what is this, how bizarre, right? there's a lot that's contained in that juxtaposition, right? That it's, seeking justice is compatible and you can patent it. And it's, that corporate capitalism and neoliberalism are not the enemies of this version of justice that's being propounded here, right? And then the last thing, and then, the seeking part. So that's this is the evangelical Christian language. So that's how you know it's the Christian part, right? And then it's interesting to think to go down to the little quotes I have beneath it to see, well, what is this model of justice that they have in mind? And so, so I begin with this quote from Isaiah: seek justice, rescue the oppressed, defend the orphan, plead for the widow. And this is from the website of the International Justice Mission. By the way, if I haven't mentioned this already, this is one of the largest evangelical Christian anti-trafficking organizations in the world. And they have operations in, 14 countries and 87 full-time staff, 87 last time I checked. I'm not sure how many now. So they're an important organization, which is why I focused on them. And it was, interesting as an ethnographer, as a sociologist, to try and figure out what was happening here. I hadn't done work so much, with evangelical Christian groups before. So this was, in that sense, it was a sort of new domain for me. But I was just trying to make my best effort to figure out what was going on and trying to sort of tease apart what they meant by justice, right? And so then that becomes clearer in the other quotes that I feature in the beginning of this chapter from Gary Hagen, the director and the CEO, as he calls himself, of the IJM, that trafficking is not a poverty issue, it's a law enforcement issue, right? And then the third one, you know, we're seeking a business takeover, a freedom business takeover of the sex business from Kerry Hilton, of an evangelical Christian social entrepreneurship or business of mission group, as they call it. So I want to say this, it was actually at an event sponsored by IJM where I was trying to, you know, figure this out in my head and, again, trying to puzzle through this dilemma where everybody seemed, surprisingly progressive to me, because when I began this research and I didn't know very much about evangelical Christians, I just assumed that they'd be the church ladies that they'd been, you know, parodied as being and demonized as being. They were young people with hip haircuts who seemed really sincere. And, you know, I talked to them and they would say, you know, that they were the black sheep in their family because they were, they thought of themselves as progressive. Some of them were supporting Obama, for example. And I was trying to figure out, these were not the evangelical Christians I expected to meet when I started doing this project. But yet there was something that didn't jive with my version of progressivism, and I kept trying to figure out what it was. And then I realized, you know, as I that every time justice was invoked, it wasn't what I meant by justice. It was a different version of justice. And then seeing it there, I actually saw it with the Christians first. I was able to take it back to the feminist field, just in terms of my own thought process, and see, oh, you know, this is also true for the feminists that I disagree with, right? It's not so much their analysis of sex, it's actually their analysis of justice that's problematic, if not more, right?
Sure. And how you get it, right? I'm still unclear on how buying the t-shirt freeze women.
Right. So I think you're referencing the not for sale freedoms. Hold your head around. Right. And so this is, you know, now we're prefiguring my analysis of redemptive capitalism here, but how does buying a t-shirt help, right? And so we can ask it of them, right, because it became very glaring, because there's something like they had this big not-for-sale freedom store, and, you know, right, where they sold products that were supposed to help trafficking victims. And so, you know, we can see it, you know, sometimes, like one of the things I like about sociology is they sometimes say it's the study of making the strange familiar and the familiar strange, right? So I started by making the strange familiar, and then making the strange familiar helped me to make the familiar strange, right? Because the evangelical Christian world was new to me, and so it was strange. And then by trying to make it familiar and, like, understand, well, like, how does this t-shirt bring justice? I could see, well, you know what? They're not the only ones doing this. Like, you know, Down in Yogurt in the grocery store has, like, a pink ribbon on the top, and you buy that, or you buy, like, Tom's shoes, or, buy this and we'll donate to that, and, you know, Eating for Good, and, you know, everything, you know, we're all, you know, a lot of us engaged in consumer capitalist practices that we're convinced are, you know, by eating more, buying more, spending more, we're saving the planet, you know what I think, like, right? So that being said, I'll, you know, in terms of the t-shirt specifically, you know, the claim here was that, you know, and there's many, many organizations that do this kind of thing in the evangelical world. So, you know, either the proceeds go to help, what they consider a good anti-trafficking organization, or, you know, you're buying products that were made by rescued trafficking victims, like, you know, earrings or bags or et cetera. And so, you know, so that was the claim. I actually had... when I was writing this book, I had a graduate student, Elena Shee, who's now a professor at Brown University, writing her own book on this. She actually did a study of the evangelical Christian rescue projects where they, you know, rescue projects in quotes, where they're making jewelry and so forth, and actually looking at the conditions in those projects. And I her work is very important. It's going to be great. It's going to come out soon as well. One of the things she talks about, and we talk about here, and we actually, you know, co-wrote one of the chapters in this book, is that, these rescue projects are not rescue projects in the way that you might think of them, right? So they are, they're, you know, former sex workers are working there, but, you know, for a variety of reasons, not because they feel rescued, but because they're older and have retired from other possibilities, and this is the next best way to make some money, right? You know, that's certainly not how it is packaged by the Christian groups, right? When they're telling you to buy for freedom, et cetera. And I'm sure we'll talk about this more in a few minutes, you know, or by corporations like The Body Shop that basically promise the same thing, you know, your soft hand stop sex trafficking campaign where you buy a hand lotion and somehow you're stopping sex trafficking, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a stretch. It's a really creative.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, why don't we let's move on to chapter 4 then, the travels of trafficking.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, so this was again, so Elena and I wrote this chapter together. One of the things that was, as she was doing her dissertation research, and I was doing my research for this book, we jointly became interested in these reality tours that we saw cropping up around trafficking, and sponsored by, you know, organizations with pretty good pedigrees, like Global Exchange, right? Pretty good progressive pedigrees, you know. So, you know, that were offering reality tours of trafficking. They weren't the only organization. We actually were initially going to do a tour with a different organization that fell through because of flooding. So we decided to do this one in the end because this one, it's Global Exchange, which is, you know, very prominent secular progressive group. And they were partnering with Not For Sale, which was, which is basically a de facto evangelical group. And, you know, and for me, this was interesting because this was a political linkage that I was already looking at and interested in. And Elena, as I mentioned, had already been in Thailand looking at these Christian jewelry projects. So she wanted to go back and see what a reality tour would feature and how they would present it. And so, you know, so we decided to make a reality tour, or ethnographic object or sociological object, and to study the tour itself, right? You know, to treat that as the thing that we wanted to understand. So we went on this tour together to Thailand, Bangkok, Chiang Mai, and Chiang Rai, following the tour and studying the tour itself, as a way of, you know, seeing a couple of things, you know, so seeing, you know, what happens when these U.S. organizations sort of exercise a kind of soft imperialism going around the world, bringing, U.S. Anti-trafficking models, discourses, you know, to another context. We certainly wanted to see that. I'd spent some time in Thailand with sex workers while I was working on my earlier book, Temporary Yours, so I knew a lot of the activists there already. I knew a lot of the organizations. Elena was just beginning to meet them. So, we also thought it would be interesting if to juxtapose, you know, what the tour was showing with what the sex worker activists were saying at the same time. So that's, you know, a lot of what structures this chapter, and it's very interesting. So, you know, groups like Empower, especially Empower Chiang Mai, how they regarded the tour, how they regarded the phenomenon. They're really local experts. I think they're a terrific organization. They know a lot. So that was, you know, another one of the things that we were trying to see, and then also what was motivating. You know, the thing that's hard about this topic for a lot of people, and sometimes, you know, my students, is they want to, you know, they have good intentions, right? As you know, as did a lot of the people who signed up for this tour. I mean, it's not that people, you know, are in a bad place in their hearts, but you know, what were they doing? What were they thinking? Why would you sign up for a tour like this? And so, looking broadly, you know, certainly. And I'm interested in the macro and the micro connections. You know, this is not a unitary phenomenon. Now, the fact that it's about sex is not unimportant. It is important. And we talk about, you know, the role that sex plays and how sex makes the tour work in a sense. You know, but it's also part of broader phenomena like slum tourism and mine tourism and so forth. And, you know, if we step back and think, this is, it's kind of weird, right? What people do now, right? That, you know, wealthy Westerners, you know, pay a lot of money to go see atrocities in other places,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
But that is a, you know, a tourist pastime. Yeah.
Family
right?
tourism is, you know, we're kind of in the midst of it here. We see a lot of, but we also see a lot of like sex tourism, obviously, in Amsterdam. But
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And in a way, this is sort of mediates between all of those things. This also, we decided, was a kind of sex tourism of its own, right? And I think, you know, one of the broader arguments of the book, this is, you know, later in the book where I talk about the place of sex. You know, so I say, you know, it's not just about sex, you know, in general, but sex is really, the fact that it is about sex is really important because sex enables, you know, a lot of other, you know, omissions, elisions, you know, sloppy thinking to happen because people get focused on the sex and stop thinking. Sense, right? And so they start feeling and stop thinking, right? And so, even if you're condemning it, even if you're fighting trafficking, in a way, it's, you know, it's a way of engaging with sex that feels moral, that feels political. That
sure.
Feels adjust.
You can engage. You're still, but, you have all this prurient interest in the sex
exactly.
trade.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, and you know, we're from a country, the U.S., that's obsessed with sex and sexual violence.
Absolutely.
Good Lord.
Right.
How many SVUs are there, you know? How many SVUs must we have?
Yeah, exactly. And that's not, you know, and I think that the obsession with sexual violence, you know, is not distinct from, you know, the broader problems with sex that, you know, that we have in the U.S., right? Because it becomes one of the a few legitimate venues we're talking about.
Yeah,
sex,
sure.
Right.
So, and one of those places where you can reaffirm your credentials as a feminist or a Christian or, you know, just a generally good moral person. Yeah. This was fascinating. I am completely interested, and I can't decide if I want to go or if I'm horrified or what.
Oh my god! On a reality tour, it's horrifying, right? You know, it's also one of the things that I think you know stands out, you know, for some people about this chapter is just, you know, how you. It's, you know, called a reality tour. You know, if there's not that much trafficking, what do you show tourists then, right? And so, like, what, you know, because that's the whole point. It's supposed to be, like, you know, a show and tell, you know, so see it with your own eyes. But there isn't really very much trafficking in Thailand anymore, so what do you do? And so, right?
That is real as reality television.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, so here's where... some of the elisions, and here's where the sex helps, right? Because, you know, so people get sort of primed to see things in particular ways. As we talk about, you know, any young Thai women on the street, you know, dressed in sort of flimsy summer clothing could become evident, you know, oh, there, maybe that's a trafficking victim, you know, and
she might be a prostitute.
Yeah. She might be a prostitute. There, I think I saw one, you know, et cetera, or just going... you know, into a bar or a club at night where, you know, people are working, that becomes evidence of trafficking. And, you know, poverty becomes evidence of trafficking, you know, any kind of sexual commerce, even though, you know, the bars in the red light districts, you know, there's a bunch of other kinds of tourist oriented commerce, you know, everybody, you know, people with some of the tourists, you know, even on our own reality tour, we, you know, sit on the streets and, you know, have four women give them a foot massage for very, you know, for very, you know, small sums. you know, without necessarily connecting that to the sexual commerce, which I found much more disturbing, but which, by the way, is much more highly paid. Right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's, yeah, that's fascinating too. Yeah, the, and the linkage between the, like, Orientalism and kind of what we call self-care is something
we're thinking about. Exactly. Ooh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, now I have to think about that. Next time I go for a massage. All right.
Yeah, indeed. Thanks. Sorry. All right.
So let's talk about redemptive capitalism. All roads have been leading us here, right?
We have been getting there, exactly. Right. And so, you know, again, this was something I have with each of these chapters, you know, I have like a theoretical concept and an empirical focus. So with carceral feminism, I focus on the particular feminist groups. Then with the militarized humanitarianism, I focus on Christian groups. With redemptive capitalism, I focus explicitly on the corporations. But all of these phenomenon sort of thread through all of the groups, right, and all of the participants. I became, you know, particularly fascinated because what I was beginning to notice towards the end of my research process, you know, was how explicitly all these large corporations were engaging with this issue and taking it on. And that really seemed bizarre to me because, you know, again, looking at various genealogies of the trafficking discourse, you and I have talked already about the feminist path there, but another one, you know, in a way less direct, but also there was the anti-globalization activism in the 1990s that was very important. But where did that critique go? Because in the 90s, you know, in the critique, so, you know, places like, Battle for Seattle and so forth, you know, corporations were the enemy, right? And so they were part of the problem in terms of where all this came from. And how is it now that, you know, corporations like Google and Manpower were presenting themselves as the solution? And so, I became aware of this through their own pretty explicit campaigns, but also, you know, they were funding a lot of the other groups, right? So a lot of the anti-trafficking organizations that were emerging, and there seemed to be more every day, I would look and ask who their funders are, and a lot of them had corporate funders. And so I became interested in that as well. And they were starting to sponsor events, and there were these MTV exit campaigns all across, you know, Southeast Asia. The Body Shop in New York had, you know, posters about trafficking and was sponsoring petitions. And so I was seeing more and more of this. And then as I was also going to political events in Washington, D.C. around this and meeting with policymakers, suddenly there'd be somebody from Google at the table, right? Or from Manpower. What were they doing there, right? Wait a minute, you know? And it was interesting, Mark Ligon, who was a very interesting figure in the sort of tail end of the Bush administration. You know, he was he's very interesting man, and he, you know, his explicit idea was to have corporations be at the forefront of this issue and to sort of forge public-private partnerships, or private-private partnerships, even called it, around this issue, and, you know, to basically have the anti-trafficking movement be corporate-led, which is so interesting and bizarre because a part of the problem is supposed to be, capitalism and economic exploitation, and if that's the reason people are economically suffering and migrating, how are corporations supposed to help? So that became the sort of research question that guided this chapter. And, you know, and so I sort of began by just sort of first documenting the extent of it and the rise of all these apps. And the industries that I was most interested in that were working on this were the tech industry and the temporary labor industry, who seem to be some of the biggest players. And so, again, there were all kinds of corporations who were working on this. Also, you know, Carlisle Hotels and hotel industry putting a lot of money into this. And so this became another really interesting research journey for me. Again, I didn't know a lot about evangelical Christians when I started writing this book. I certainly hadn't done any ethnographic research with corporate social responsibility boards before before this project. But it led me there. And I became interested in what kinds of issues corporations invest in and why and how they choose them, what they're hoping to accomplish, right? So I did... you know, interviews and participated at Google events and Silicon Valley events because the tech industry was so big a mess, and interviews with executives from groups like LexisNexis and Manpower who were becoming more and more prominent. And so this is sort of what led me to this notion of redemptive capitalism. You know, I think it's, you know, what does it mean? What does redemptive capitalism mean? You know, it's an interesting phrase, which, you know, I think tries to capture a couple of things. But what I'm most trying to get at here is how capitalists themselves are trying to redeem their own role in, you know, in fomenting poverty and inequality and gender exploitation and so forth. And I think, you know, as with the tourists we were talking about earlier, I think a lot of these people are well-intentioned, but, you know, there's contradiction here. Nobody wants to face head on, right? And so, so if you ask, you know, why an organization like Manpower, which is the largest temporary labor organization in the world, one of the largest private sector employers in the United States, you know, is getting interested in this issue, you have to think, okay, what, and some of the people in this field would say so directly, well, it has to work in terms of the economic interests of the company, right? If you're going to take on an issue, it has to be, business people will say this directly, right? You know, and how does it work for us? You know, and so, you know, I have some of the visuals from the End Human Trafficking Now campaign, right? Ending human trafficking is smart business, right? I mean, they would say this directly. If it's temporary labor, what is this? You know, people get paid by the piece, very little. They have no benefits, right? You know, these are very lousy jobs that are more and more prevalent at this moment of post-industrial economies. People migrate for these jobs. They also do organizations like Manpower and other companies. They also do brokered labor arrangements, right? This is part of where the title of the book comes from, thinking about, you know, the brokering of many kinds of subjects and many kinds of labor. So, you know, so migrant workers, you know, moving from place to place, for example, you know, from China to the Philippines, you know, will often have to work before they get paid, right? They will have to lay out money at the outset. They will have very little control over their labor. They'll be shuttled around without knowing what's going on. Things that sound a lot, and can even feel a lot, like what we call trafficking, right? And this is just legitimate corporate practice. Yes,
absolutely.
Right?
But like, let's put that fine a point on it, right? We have women who are working as like independent contractors for themselves, or perhaps we can get them to make these earrings we'll sell.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be clear on exactly what redemptive capitalism looks like, which you are, although you're not, I mean, you're very clear on this.
Right. So, you know, what I hear and what you just said is just, you know, what does redemption consist of, right? So how, you know, what do they imagine is redeeming about capitalism, right? You know, why is making earrings more redemptive than selling your own sexual labor, for example, right? And here's the sex piece again, right? And so, I think this is another way to think about the importance of sex, circling back to an earlier moment in our conversation, right? It's not just pro-sex, anti-sex. It's not just puritanism or sexual freedom. It's the other work that sex does. So one of the ways in which it's, I think it becomes not just like politically, but also economically important to demonize sex, the sale of sex, is because then by contrast, all other forms of commerce look moral, right? So at least sex is not being sold, right? So, you know, if sex is on the bad side of the line, right, then everything else can be on the good side of the line, right? At least they don't have to sell their bodies and they don't have to sell sex, right? Becomes the argument, right? So that's why selling earrings, you know, making earrings, for less money, for more hours, with less control over your movements and who you see, with less control over your labor, can look like freedom and redemption.
Sure. Right. You know, this is a long-standing conversation I have with people who are really opposed to the sex trade. It's like, draw the line for me between waiting tables and prostitution, you know, like where do you, I mean, there's a couple clear places, right? But one of these makes a lot more money than the other.
Right.
Yeah.
Why does it become so important? I think this was something I really hadn't thought about in this way before writing this book, because I figure things out while I'm writing books. You know, I've thought about sexual politics for a long time, right? Yeah, you know, so I've been thinking about, you know, sort of, you know, as I was saying earlier, you know, what are the broader politics that influence sexual politics? But conversely, right, what does sexual politics do for everything else, right? So if sex is the bad thing, if sex is the true moral wrong, that makes everything else legitimate. We don't need to criticize it. So you can have seek justice TM and capitalism can look good, and we don't have to criticize that, or we don't have to criminalize, we don't have to criticize the criminal justice system or the carceral state or securitized borders, right? If the real, if we now we've isolated and located what the problem is, and it's just sex, then everything else looks, you know, relatively benign by comparison.
All right. Yeah, perfect. Oh, it's so it's so easy. All right. Let's wrap this up. I've taken up so much of your time, but I'm having such a great conversation with you.
It's really fun.
So let's talk about imagining freedom. Ta-da.
Okay, great. Yeah. Imagining freedom. So one of the, you know, things I try to do in this chapter, and I try not to, however hard the book or the topic, I like to think about, you know, what other imaginations of freedom could be, just to leave us with some hope, which is, I think, important in hard times. So here's really where a lot of the sex worker activist voices come in and really forge, I think, a dramatic contrast with the implicit imaginations of freedom that are contained in the anti trafficking discourse and by the anti-trafficking activists. And so, you know, so one of the things I try to focus on here is what I call, at least, you know, there were new activisms when I wrote this chapter, but they're still relatively new. You know, so not just sex worker activism, which, you know, we've had since the 70s and Coyote in San Francisco, to get something I write about in my earlier work. What was giving me some hope as I was writing this last chapter were the new forms of both sex worker activism and other kinds of left and progressive activisms that were sufficiently intersectional that they could actually think about sex work in progressive ways, which usually doesn't happen. I mean, so part of, you know, I think one of the challenges for sex worker activism, well, there are several, but one of them has been, certain varieties of progressive and left politics have also made the mistake of designating sex as a special category and then not interrogating it sufficiently enough. And so, you know, people who are sort of progressive in other ways have not, I think, necessarily thought in progressive ways around sex. They've regarded it as a special case. And so what was a special case and a problematic case and sort of accepted the mainstream discourse, you know, so, you know, people like Rachel Maddow or, you know, Democracy Now or people who should know better haven't known better. Right. And so what was inspiring me as I was writing this chapter is that I was finding people who were doing better and I was seeing some intersections that really excited me and seemed to have some potential. So, for example, you know, when Occupy was happening in New York, there was a sex worker rights contingent that was, you know, working with Occupy and linking the issues of the 2008 financial crisis, gender and sexuality politics, and with sex worker rights. And I just thought that was terrific, right? I mean, and those were the kinds of meldings and connections that needed to be made at an activist level, I thought, to get us through this and to put forth another discourse around this. You know, similarly, when the Women's March happened, there was a lot of, and I talk about this in this chapter, you know, the sort of back and forth, and it wasn't a smooth path, and there were various, you know, iterations. But in the end, you know, the version of the first Women's March that went forward was pro-sex worker rights, and that was on the platform. And that was amazing because this was, you know, this was mainstream feminism in the U.S. And I never thought I would sort of see a mainstream, you know, especially after, you know, all this trafficking stuff had reemerged again, you know, really embracing sex workers' rights in a profound way. Because that's going to be necessary, right? If the only way you talk about you know, either as a feminist or as a progressive person on the left, if the only time you mention sex work is to talk about the horrors of sex trafficking, then you're not helping, right? You know, you have to do something affirmative for sex workers and sex workers' rights, and right. And so it seemed, it seemed like we were seeing some of that, and that, those were the new activists. Black Lives Matter too. You know, I mentioned this also in the book. Was, you know, this is another, you know, really important new activism in a U.S. context. You know, had just, you know, great and, you know, unexpected engagement with the issue of sex workers' rights and anti-criminalization, anti-carcerality. And I know some of the people, personally worked on this to fold it into the platform. And so these are things that I was actually finding, some inspiration in, and I still do. I have an afterword to the book also where I'm a little bit more, which is after Trump's election, and which is just a little bit more tentative, and then I think part of what happened with the Hillary Clinton's loss of the presidency, because everybody expected her to win, is then then there was a kind of scrambling and a regrouping, and in some of the the kinds of feminism which I find less helpful have now reconstituted themselves again. First in what I write about in the afterword is, national security feminism, but then subsequently, in some of the strands of Me Too that have become ascendant. And, I didn't want to get into a whole other thing in the afterword again, but it's there in a little footnote in the very last sentence, in terms of which feminism is going to be ascendant. A lot's going to hinge on that, right? Whether it's these kinds of, deeply and legitimately intersectional feminisms that are really thinking about, the intersections of not just identity categories, but global politics and sexual politics, and vice versa, the effect of sexual politics on global politics. Because we need to read both ways, or a kind of more narrowly focused, self-involved, I think deliberately occluding a kind of version of feminism that doesn't question criminal justice, that doesn't question punishment as the solution, that or carcerality or the carceral state or capitalism or anything that we're seeing again in some strains of Me Too. So it's a little less hopeful by the time I wrote the afterword, because that was emerging, and in addition to the rise of Donald Trump. So I'm still in an ambivalent space about this, but I think that's the crossroads at which we sit. Right.
Yeah, I'm looking at the final sentence of the book, whether it's this vision of feminism or carceral feminism, the national security feminism, which is a great term. This actually, because that'll of course reflect other trends and will affect other trends. It is an interesting moment in that kind of, old curse way in the world right now, isn't it?
It is a really interesting moment. It is a really interesting moment. And one moment I feel hopeful and one moment I feel despairing. And so I think it's changing very quickly, and it depends on where you look. And, what I try to do when things are feeling grim somewhere, I look somewhere else. And so I think one of your questions for me was, what other projects I'm working on. One of the books I'm trying to finish up with my colleague, Janet Jacobson, we've been part of this project on gender and sexuality and neoliberalism, or what we're now calling post-neoliberalism, and sort of looking actually at 12 different countries together, and we have collaborators in Argentina and Mexico and, working in Nigeria and Hong Kong and, different parts in India. And so just trying to sort of think about, some of these dynamics, as they circulate globally and as they disperse globally too. And so, so there's different things going on in different places. I mean, there's some continuities and some circulations which are quite interesting. Like, for example, for the new book we're working on, I co-authored a chapter with three other authors looking at the circulations of the trafficking discourse between the U.S. and and Hong Kong and Argentina and Nigeria. And you know, in that case, there's a lot of continuities. But, you know, in other cases, you know, there's some just different things happening in different parts of the world that can give us hope sometimes. So so I'll offer you that. Mexico is looking better now than that.
Well, all right then. We can carry that ahead with us. That'll be looking good. Oh, wonderful! Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to more of your work. I am actually teaching a chapter of this book this fall.
Oh, wonderful! Yeah, really. Which excited. Chapter are you teaching?
I was thinking. Oh, I've been going back and forth, but I think carceral feminism.
Right.
Really think. Yeah, and I'll make everything else available. But we do sex trafficking, or we do sex work, sex versus sex trafficking, and kind mm-hmm. of the why is sex so important to this discussion. Anyway, so that's really exciting.
Great.
All right, Elizabeth, thank you so much. And
thank you.
All right, take care.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. Okay. All right. Bye bye.